Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're pulling a name off the shelf that I think a lot of you have probably filed away under, well, under high school history, do not open.
Right.
We're talking about John Locke. And I have to admit, before digging into this stack of research for today, I essentially thought of him as just a dusty wig in a textbook. You know, important, sure, but dry.
Yeah, that is the reputation he has, unfortunately. He doesn't really have the rock star energy of someone like Nietzsche or the rebellious vibe of Rousseau. He just seems very
safe.
Safe, exactly. But it's deceptive.
It really is, because after reading through these notes and articles, my perspective is completely flipped. It feels like we aren't just reading history here. We're reading the source code for the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
The sources actually argue that Locke is effectively the guy who walked into the dark room of the Middle Ages and just found the light switch.
It's a powerful metaphor, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And it's not just one that we're applying in hindsight. That is exactly how they viewed themselves. I mean, we are talking about the Enlightenment, after all. They genuinely believed they were dispelling the shadows of the past.
So that's our mission for this deep dive. We want to understand what the Enlightenment actually is for you all, not just as a timeline on a syllabus, but as a specific way of processing reality.
Right.
We want to see how Locke software is still running in our heads today. And we also need to talk about a major glitch in that software that philosophy is honestly still trying to fix.
Yeah, it's a glitch that leads to some fairly existential crises, but we will get there.
We will.
Yeah.
But let's start by setting the scene.
Mm.
The sources highlight this specific year. 1691. This is when Locke publishes his essay concerning human understanding. Why is this exact moment the turning point?
Well, you have to look at what the intellectual landscape was like right before this. So the 17th century was totally dominated by what we call the system builders. Cool. Think of people like Descartes or Spinoza, and these were absolute geniuses, but they were trying to build these massive fortress-like systems of knowledge. They'd usually start from abstract concepts of God or geometry and then work their way down to everything else.
So they're trying to build a perfect theory of everything from the top down.
Precisely. It was very rigid. But Locke kicks off the 18th century and the whole vibe changes. It stops being about building fortresses and starts being about inspection, criticism. It becomes the age of the scientific mind.
Right.
And when we use the word enlightenment, we have to be very, very specific. We aren't talking about, you know, spiritual enlightenment or some mystical awakening.
But the light of reason.
Yes. And specifically, reason as defined by science. Inductive and deductive logic. There's this great line from the poet Alexander Hope, who was writing around this exact time, that really captures the mood.
Oh, yeah, I saw this in the notes.
He wrote, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light."
Let Newton be, and all was light. I mean, that is incredibly arrogant, isn't it?
It really is.
It implies that for thousands of years, humanity was just stumbling around in the dark until a guy with a wig and some calculus showed up to fix it all.
It is arrogant, but that was the energy at the time. They were completely obsessed with objective mathematical certainty.
Yeah.
They looked at what Newton did for physics, you know, explaining gravity and motion with fixed, unbreakable laws.
Right.
And I said, well, why can't we do that for everything else? They wanted to understand the human mind, ethics, politics, all of it with the same clarity that Newton understood an apple falling from a tree.
So let's look at this Enlightenment mindset then. If the light is on, what exactly are we seeing? Because the research points to a massive rise in skepticism.
Skepticism is the primary tool they use to clear the ground. There was this newfound refusal to just accept tradition or authority simply because it was old.
Right.
In the past, saying because the king said so or because the church fathers wrote it was a perfectly valid argument. For Locke and his peers, that just stopped working.
Now, this brings up a really nuanced point from the sources regarding religion. Because yeah. I think there's a modern misconception that the Enlightenment was strictly anti-religious. But Locke was a Christian.
He was a fairly devout one, actually. But the structure of faith changed. And this is a subtle but critical shift.
Okay.
Before the Enlightenment, revelation, meaning what God revealed in Scripture, that was the foundation. Reason was just a tool you used to understand revelation. But in the Enlightenment, that hierarchy flips completely. Reason becomes the foundation.
So reason is the cake? And revelation is the icing.
That is a brilliant way to put it. Revelation became an add-on. It was something extra that you could accept, provided it didn't contradict reason.
Mm-hmm.
But this rule of reason wasn't just about theology or high philosophy. It was about how you live your daily life. And this is where the research brought up that analogy about the rental car.
Yes, the Avis analogy. I have to say, I did not expect to see a 20th century marketing slogan in a deep dive about 17th century philosophy.
It is unexpected, but it explains their concept of freedom so perfectly.
So, just for you listening, the old slogan for Avis Rent-A-Car was, "We're driven."
Right. It was, "We try harder, and we're driven."
And the source uses this to explain the difference between true freedom and just being driven by impulse. The idea is that if you act out of emotional compulsion, like if you eat just because you're hungry, scream because you're mad, or sleep because you're tired, you aren't actually free.
No, you're being driven. You are like the rental car. Your biology or your emotions are literally in the driver's seat steering you around.
That is a heavy realization. I think most people today, if you ask them, would define freedom as just doing what I feel like doing.
And Locke would say that is slavery. If you're ruled by your passions, you are a slave to your passions. True freedom, in the Enlightenment sense, requires detachment.
You have to step back.
You have to step back from the impulse. Look at it. Analyze it with that light of reason, and then consciously decide whether to act on it.
So freedom isn't the absence of restraint. It's the presence of rational self-control.
Exactly. It's the rule of reason applied to yourself. And you can see how this scales up from the individual right to the state.
Oh, sure.
If you have a society where everyone just follows their immediate impulses, you don't have a free society. You have a mob. It's anarchy. Political freedom is only possible under the rule of law, which is essentially just the rule of reason written down on paper.
That distinction naturally leads to another major shift mentioned in the notes, this move from the good to the right. Now, on the surface, that sounds like semantic wordplay. What is the actual difference there?
It is a massive shift in ethical focus. So in the Middle Ages, the main concern was teleological, which just means it was focused on the end goal.
The destination.
Right. They were striving for the good, which usually meant God or salvation. The driving question was always, where are we going?
Okay, got it.
The Enlightenment shifts the focus completely over to the right. This is deontological. It's about principles, rules, and procedures. It becomes less about the final destination and much more about the rules of the road. It's about setting up a fair framework, a right way to interact with each other, regardless of what your personal version of the good might be.
That sounds exactly like the American Constitution. It doesn't tell you what the meaning of life is. It just gives you a legal framework to pursue whatever you happen to think the meaning of life is.
The U.S. Constitution is the ultimate Enlightenment document. It is literally a procedural manual for a rational society. And Locke is the architect of that mindset. His concept of rights, life, liberty, property, those are the boundaries of the right.
Okay, so we have this framework now. We're rational creatures, ruling ourselves by logic, building a society based on laws. But Locke realizes there's a problem here.
A big one.
Right. If we're going to rule our entire lives by reason, we kind of need to know where our thoughts come from in the first place. Where do we get the data to reason with?
And this brings us to Locke's theory of ideas, or what you might call his hard drive theory.
And he starts this by clearing the deck. He spends a lot of time telling us what we do not have.
He completely rejects innate ideas.
Meaning ideas we are just born with.
Correct. Now, why is he so focused on doing this? He was targeting a very specific group called the Cambridge Platonists.
Which, again, sounds like a great indie band.
It really does. But they were a group of philosophers who really disliked the mechanical, scientific view of the world. They firmly believed humans had innate moral knowledge.
Like it was pre-installed.
Yes, that we were born knowing right from wrong, born with the idea of God already printed on our souls. They wanted that level of security.
And Locke says, no, that's simply not true.
He essentially says, prove it. And he uses a very blunt, almost brutal argument to dismantle their view. He points to what he called children and idiots.
With idiots being the medical term at the time for people with severe cognitive delays, not just a playground insult.
Right, exactly. Locke's logic is devastatingly simple here. He says, if an idea like do not kill or God exists were truly innate, if it was factory installed by God, then every single human being should have it. It should be a universal consensus.
But babies don't know the Ten Commandments.
Exactly. Children don't know the principles of logic. People with severe cognitive limitations might not be able to articulate these supposed universal truths. Locke argues that if even one person doesn't have the idea, it cannot logically be innate.
So if nothing is factory installed,
then we have to install it ourselves, which leads to his most famous concept of all, the tabula rasa.
The blank slate.
The mind is a totally blank piece of white paper. Experience is the pen. Everything we know, everything we believe, comes solely from what we see, hear, taste, and touch.
I want to push on this a bit, though, because we mentioned earlier that Locke was a Christian. If we start as a total blank slate, does that mean we just invent the idea of God based on our experiences?
That is the danger zone, right? But Locke navigates it very carefully. He argues that we don't invent God, but we deduce him. Locke had a strong Puritan background, and he believed that the visible marks of extraordinary wisdom in creation were so incredibly obvious that any rational person who just looked at the natural world would conclude there has to be a creator.
So it's not a gut instinct. It's a logical conclusion.
Yes. It's basically Romans chapter 1 from the Bible, but interpreted strictly through a scientist's lens.
Yeah.
He thinks God gave us a brain and a world full of evidence, and he just expects us to do the math.
Okay. So we are blank slates. We take in data from the physical world. Now we get to the actual mechanics. How does the mind process that data? Because this is where that physics envy really comes back in, right?
Big time. We have to remember, Locke was personal friends with Isaac Newton. He saw what Newton did with atoms, breaking the entire physical universe down into these tiny, indivisible particles of matter.
Right.
Locke thought, I can do that, but for the mind.
Atoms of thought.
He calls them simple ideas.
Give me an example of a simple idea.
Blue.
Just blue.
Or cold. Or bitter. A simple idea deals with one uniform sensation. You can't break blue down into smaller parts. It just is what it is. It's a single atom of experience.
And then we act like mental chemists and just mix them together.
Exactly. We combine them into complex ideas. So you take the simple idea of blue, the simple idea of rectangular, the simple idea of soft, and your mind combines them to form the complex idea of a blue shirt.
It really is just mental Legos.
It is. But here is where Locke drops a bomb that philosophy still hasn't fully recovered from. He makes a really crucial distinction between the qualities of the object itself and the qualities in our mind. He calls them primary and secondary qualities.
This was the part of the research where I honestly started questioning my own reality. We need to break this down carefully.
Okay, let's do it. Primary qualities are the objective properties of matter. These are things that are actually in the object.
All right.
Think of a snowball. It has a shape. It's round. It has a size. It has a motion. If every human on Earth suddenly vanished, the snowball would still be round and it would still take up space. Those are real.
Okay. Primary equals real. Got it.
Now, secondary qualities. The snowball is white. It's cold. If you hold it too long, it causes pain. Locke says these qualities are not in the snowball.
Wait. The snowball isn't cold.
Physics tells us the snowball just has particles moving at a certain speed. That motion is the primary quality. When those moving particles touch your hand, they interact with your nerves to produce the sensation of cold in your mind. The cold is in you. The motion is in the snowball.
And the white.
The snowball has a surface texture that reflects certain light waves. But the actual experience of whiteness, that is just a video playing in your brain.
That is slightly disturbing. It means a huge chunk of what we experience is reality every day. Colors, smells, tastes, sounds. It's all just a simulation running in our heads.
It's a simulation caused by the outside world, yes, but it strictly exists in the mind. And this leads us to the biggest problem in Locke's philosophy. We call it the problem of knowledge.
I can see the trapdoor opening right now. If I'm not seeing the whiteness out there, but I'm only seeing the idea of white in here. And if all I have access to are these ideas.
Exactly. You found the glitch in the matrix. If we only know our ideas are representations of the world, how do we know the outside world is actually even there? How do I know the snowball exists at all? Maybe I'm just hallucinating the whole thing.
Right. It's like being locked in a windowless security room watching monitors. You can see the street outside on the screen, but if you can never leave the room, how do you know the screen isn't just playing a pre-recorded tape?
That is the classic philosophical dilemma of representation. We only know the map. We never know the territory. Now, Locke sees this problem clearly, and he has a solution. But ironically, for a man obsessed with reason, it isn't a scientific one.
What is it?
He relies on theology. He argues that God gave us our senses. And since God is fundamentally good, it would be an absolute affront to God's character to suggest that he gave us senses just to chronically deceive us. Therefore, we just have to trust them.
So his entire scientific, rational, bottom-up philosophy ultimately rests on trust God, he wouldn't lie to you.
It does. And for Locke, that was enough. But for the generation that followed him, it was blood in the water.
This is where we start sliding toward the cliff.
The slippery slope to David Hume. Locke sets the stage, but David Hume, who comes just a bit later in the Enlightenment, takes this empiricist ball and runs right off the edge of the cliff. Hume says, okay, Locke, I like your rule that we only know what we experience. Let's stick strictly to that.
And Locke says, great.
And then Hume says, well, have you ever experienced God directly? No. So you can't prove he exists. Have you ever experienced the external world directly? No, only your ideas of it. So you can't prove the world exists either.
Wow. He takes Locke's own weapon and just points it right at Locke's foundation.
He goes even further than that. He says, have you ever experienced yourself?
Whoa. How do you lose yourself? I'm right here.
Are you? Hume says, look inside. Introspect. Do you actually see a soul? Do you see a self? Or do you just see a constantly shifting bundle of flashing images? I'm hungry. I see blue. I remember Tuesday.
It's just a stream of data.
It's a playlist with no one listening to it. This is Hume's famous bundle theory. He argues there is no driver in the car at all. There is just the driving.
That is terrifying. It's total nihilism.
It is total skepticism. And the dark irony is Locke is the one who set it up. He wanted to create a world ruled by reason and certainty to get away from the system builders. But by defining knowledge as just ideas based on experience, he unintentionally opened the door to questioning whether we can actually know anything at all.
It's like he built this beautiful, rational house, but he forgot to bolt it to the foundation.
And Hume just came along and blew it over.
So where does that actually leave us today? Because we don't live in a world of total nihilism. We clearly still operate on Locke's system.
We do. Despite the massive philosophical holes, Locke's software is absolutely still running the West. We still deeply believe in the blank slate, that education and environment shape us much more than destiny. We still believe in the rule of law. We still prize scientific objectivity over everything.
We're living in the world Locke built, even if the basement is a little flooded.
Absolutely. Our modern political systems, our very concept of human rights, it all starts right here.
Sure.
But there is one final thought from the source material that I think is really worth chewing on before we wrap up today.
Lay it on us.
It's about the American ethos that directly came out of this. We tend to view freedom as the absolute highest value. You hear it in our political discourse constantly. Freedom is the ultimate goal.
Sure. Land of the free. It's literally the brand.
But the source suggests that this might actually be a distortion from a Judeo-Christian standpoint, which is exactly the standpoint Locke was coming from. The highest social value isn't freedom. It's justice.
Justice.
Right. Think about the distinction there. Freedom is a tool. You need freedom in order to pursue justice. But freedom without justice, that is just the strong eating the weak. That is the driven mob we talked about earlier with the rental car analogy.
The source even goes so far as to suggest that our modern obsession with absolute unrestricted freedom is actually a pagan idea, not a Christian one.
It does. It suggests that by elevating freedom to the very top, we've actually abandoned Locke's rule of reason. We've forgotten that freedom is supposed to be the means to a just society, not the end in itself.
That is a serious reality check for you all to think about.
Right.
We might have taken the liberty part of Locke and run a little too far with it, completely forgetting the reason part.
It's definitely something to think about. Are we actually striving for a just society, or are we just enjoying the ride in the rental car?
Locke gives us the keys, but he doesn't drive the car for us.
Indeed, he doesn't.
Well, that is a lot to process, from the atoms of thought to the glitch in reality. Thank you for walking us through the mind of John Locke today.
My pleasure.
And to everyone listening, thanks for diving deep with us. Yeah. Hopefully the lights are a little brighter for you now. We'll see you next time.